Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading more from My Beloved Monster, Masha, the half-wild rescue cat who rescued me, by Caleb Carr, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles from some newsletters and from some magazines about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with My Beloved Monster, Masha, the half-wild rescue cat who rescued me, by Caleb Carr. In the previous chapter, we learned that Masha's wound from the fissure cost her beautiful tail. Her struggle to recover was perilous, and Caleb tried to strike a bargain with a higher power in order to save her. The remaining afternoon and night passed quietly. Two cats had kindly come for a visit after I told her of Masha's misfortune, and in the morning one of my nephews came to the house as well, and there had been news. The review of the new book was not only to be in the Times Book Review, it was to be on the cover, and if we heard any more, it was going to be a rave. Our reviews had also come in, all remarkably positive, and that morning that Masha's second surgery, the Times Review went online. It was many things, a rave, though with one or two gentle barbs to temper it, but even more generous and gracious. As we sat around the computer reading it, two cats and my nephew were sent into rounds of cheers. When they paused, a sound became audible. Masha, bunny hopping down the nearby stairs. She'd heard the happy sounds and emerged from the upper study, wanting to be part of the excitement. And when she turned the corner from the staircase, her eyes were wide, her face was very relieved, and her step as if a gigantic weight had been lifted from her, or literally her back end. She trotted over to and under the desk where I was sitting and drew her side against my legs, then turned to stare up at me. The enormous pupils of those eyes ringed in light, bright green, and her face full of a big, glowing smile. Exactly the way one should look and feel after a successful surgery has put an end to suffering. I put my hand to her head and face, and she drew her teeth and chin against it, as though the nightmare days had just been past, a cruel, inescapable vision had gone. Two cats stood by me after we'd all acknowledged Masha's apparent recovery and indicated the computer, asking if I wasn't happy. I mumbled assent, keeping my real thoughts about the book simple and quiet. "It won't work," I whispered, believing it. I looked down and smiled at Masha and ran another fingertip against her teeth and chin, deeply pleased that I'd made the deal. None of it will work ever now. And none of it did. The book died almost immediately, good reviews notwithstanding, and the people who were the new gatekeepers of all things cultural, online, anonymous, usually angry critics, got their say. Things became worse than bad. None of it surprised me, intellectually. I'd known the book was a gamble, but on a deeper, more metaphysical level, I continued to believe that I'd bargained away any possible success. I remained fine with that, so long as Masha was truly recovering and well. Which she was. I took her to have her bandage removed after a day or two at which the pert little bobtail was revealed, not the glory of her former extremity, perhaps, but in its own way a sassy reflection of a different side of her character. Once back home and able to reflect at her leisure, during the weeks following the battle, Masha sometimes seemed taken aback by the larger tail's absence, but she also seemed ultimately happy to have traded it for a release from the pain it had given her in those terrible days after the fissure. And perhaps there was even more to her relief. I couldn't help but remember from her first vet's initial visit and diagnosis of her arthritis that the disease had been present in the tail joint along with her hips. The bobtail genuinely seemed, once she got psychologically used to it, to give her less discomfort, just though it was a lightness to her. And she still had its few inches of length to twitch when prey was in the offing or when something was intriguing her. True, her ability to run flat out for anything but short distances was further eroded by not having the counterbalance, and she would never try to climb a tree again, the tail being vital to climbing too. But she'd been slowly slowing down anyway, and her runs around the porch or up the stairs from her box seemed enough for her. She accepted the new reality with grace, and thus a new era of our life was born. She eventually did return to patrolling in the months to come, but she curtailed the extent of her work, quickly validating my belief that she knew how to adjust to altered circumstances. She came up with a new set of rules for her behavior outside the house and beyond the porch. She might occasionally go to the top of the stairway to nowhere and gaze down it, or to study the tall hay at the western edge of our lawn from a distance, but she would not tempt them again. Her perimeter was now marked by the richly grassed knoll halfway down the driveway, with its ash, maple, and apple copse. It was a spot surrounded by open spaces that she could survey at any time, and that always offered easy escape up the big, gently curved boughs of the several ash trees which she could ascend simply by walking. Yet, it remained impossible to believe that Masha was now a truly senior cat. The eyes and face and expression were still those of a youngster I'd first brought home, even if her body was now heavier and her tail abbreviated. She still liked to play, but less and less physically. The mouse on the little fishing pole made a reappearance, though it no longer amused her for a very long time. Nobody really knew or knows the lifespan of Siberians outside of kitten mills, where it is thought to be 12 to 15 years, but it was a question I now began to research as Masha had passed her 12th birthday. Big breed cats, Siberians, Maine Coons, Ragdolls, and the like, all are thought to live shorter less than the American shorthairs. But Masha had never cared for any such theories. Younger or older, she'd always been and remained a law unto herself, and she had just proven so unbelievably. For several summers after her encounter with the fisher, I sometimes hunted the beast at night from the vantage point of the back porch with my night vision-enabled 20/23 rifle. But the big weasel, like the bear, never returned, leaving me to sometimes imagine the two of them, scar-faced and disbelieving, trading war stories about the hellcat who guarded the stone house and its grounds. Wherever the two were, Masha had not only done her self-appointed job, but also, and most importantly, lived to tell of it. She could indeed retire a champion, but would she? Next week we'll find out the answer to that question. In My Beloved Monster, Masha, the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, by Caleb Carr. Our next reading comes from Paw Prints, a newsletter of the North Shore Animal League, Issue 4, Winter 2024. Our no-kill commitment saves a pregnant cat on the brink of death. At the heart of North Shore Animal League America's no-kill mission are stories like Little Betty's. Only 7 months old and pregnant, the precious cat's life hung the balance. Through the collaborative efforts of our North Country Initiative, NCI, team in Warren County, New York, and our staff and volunteers on Long Island, Little Betty not only survived against the odds, but emerged as a symbol of hope for countless animals in need. NCI Director Deborah Olgrini remembered the day that her facility got a knock on the door from Little Betty's owner, who was holding the suffering feline in her arms. The cat had recently delivered two deceased kittens and was gravely ill from a third that was left stuck in her pelvic canal. Sadly, she'd been spayed and she was physically unable to handle her pregnancy. Since Little Betty's owner could not provide veterinary care for her, the situation would likely have been fatal, but true to our no-kill commitment, we weren't going to give up on her. We gave the go-ahead to rush Little Betty to the local animal hospital for emergency surgery to save her life. Post-surgery, Little Betty was transported to our pet center. She was having difficulty eliminating on her own, and it was not clear whether she had permanent nerve damage from her ordeal or a possible genetic deficit. Little Betty needed more time to heal, so we could determine her prognosis. We found just the right nurturing environment for her in the home of Katrina, one of our dedicated foster parents. Initially, Katrina kept Little Betty isolated to ensure her recovery. Over time, and with much monitoring and patience, she regarded her strength and mobility. With assistance from our feline behavior team, Katrina was finally able to introduce Little Betty to her resident cat, Pugsley. The two cats began sharing meals and playtime and eventually cuddling together during naps. It was a bond Katrina did not want to break and decided to officially adopt little Betty, telling us, "Pug is absolutely in love with her, and I can't imagine separating them." Little Betty is the joyful companion of Katrina and Pugsley today, thanks to our no-kill commitment. Each rescue, each emergency treatment, each adoption we make possible strengthens our resolve to fight for those who cannot speak for themselves. With our vast network of supporters and dedicated Animal League America team, we will continue to change lives, one animal at a time. This article from Paw Prints, a newsletter of North Shore Animal League America, Issue 4, Winter 2024. Our no-kill commitment saves pregnant cat on brink of death. Our next article is from The Guideway, Volume 78, Number 2, Fall 2024. The Glory of a Guide Dog by Linda Newton. Linda Newton was born prematurely, and in the 1950s, premature babies were often put on oxygen-rich environments to help them survive. However, the use of too much oxygen can cause damage to the blood vessels in the eyes, leading to a condition known as retinopathy of prematurity, which results in vision loss. I was an incubator baby, and all of those NICU, or NICU, neonatal intensive care units, doctors saved me. They gave me my life instead of giving up on me, she says. When Newton was a child, she had the opportunity to attend the Overbrook School for the Blind in Pennsylvania. She would have had to live at the school and return home only on weekends and holidays, but her mother wanted her at home so she would be a part of the family. As the oldest of seven children, she also helped with her younger siblings. Newton went to public school, but in the days before federal laws required equal access to education, each time she changed schools, her mother would meet with the principal to ensure that her daughter would be permitted to attend. Her family moved often when she was growing up, and that made me adventurous, Newton said. I was wild. I loved to skate. I loved to swim. I only see light, so I don't know how I did it, but I rode a bicycle all around town with my friends. My mother and father always believed I could do anything I put my mind to. They did always understand what had to be done and what resources were there. But I was the daughter, and they loved me. Finding her voice. It wasn't until college, Newton says, that I realized I had to be realistic about the choice of a career. She had always loved to sing and encouraged by her grandfather. I trained in college with my first voice lesson, she says. I had kind of an operatic-sounding voice, but it's tricky for blind folks to do opera and run the stage unless you do other things. So I specialized in what they called Lieder. Lieder in German means songs, but for fans of classic music, it refers to those songs with piano accompaniment between 1800 and 1900. Newton was teamed with her first guide dog, Kim, when she was 24 years old. She'd been teaching at an elementary school in St. James, New York, and a Guide Dog Foundation graduate would come in and visit with the students. It was inspiring, she says, but I still wasn't convinced. That changed when another friend took her around Manhattan to show her how easily she could navigate the city with a guide dog. So they set up an interview, and I came to the Guide Dog Foundation, she says. Newton was studying for her master's in music at the University of Boulder when she received a Fulbright scholarship to study abroad. I got to live in Europe for 3 years and study and sing and learn languages, she says. With Holland as her home base, she and her guide dog Kim traveled all over Europe performing. I grew in so many ways. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. When she returned to the United States, Newton sang professionally and worked for the National Endowment for the Arts on the Artist-in-Residence roster. I would travel around the country, and people would invite me to come to their schools, she says. Not only would she teach music, how to sing, and musically perform for students, she would also educate them about guide dogs and guide dog etiquette. Building a family. Newton met her husband, Greg, when they were both studying at the St. Louis Conservatory in Missouri. He was also a singer. I didn't have time to read all the fun stuff, so when we would take breaks during rehearsals, Greg would read to me. The first book he ever read to me was Treasure Island. Greg was a widower with three sons, and then he and Newton had two sons together. They've been married for 37 years. Our oldest and youngest sons are 18 years apart, she says. The older three were so happy to have younger brothers. Both Newton and her husband traveled around the country performing, and she would often travel to where he was performing, boys in tow. Eventually, however, they decided to step back so that they could devote more attention to their sons. My youngest got to the point where he just needed to be home with his brothers, she says. I took on small performing jobs that were closer to home so I didn't have to travel. They both did community theater, and Newton worked in schools. Sometimes I worked schedules with my teaching so Greg could come and sing when he was in an opera somewhere, she says. As a family, they would take bicycle trips or read together. When the boys were younger, we read all the books I've never read. We were an artsy family, she said. A lifetime of guide dogs. Newton has had guide dogs for almost 50 years. All have been from the Guide Dog Foundation, and each has matched a stage in her life. My first dog was just like me, feisty and energetic, she says. She got her next dog just as she married and was teaching. Esther loved going to school. She liked being with all the children. When the boys were young, they were involved with scouting and camping, and Daisy, her third dog, was the perfect dog for the Cub Scouts. With their sons grown and out of the house, a few years ago, Newton and her husband decided to retire to Arizona. At the time, she was on her fourth guide, Marshawn, sponsored by Marshawn Eyewear. Marshawn was the perfect transitional dog as the Newtons adjusted to life in Arizona. The couple may be retired, but they are far from inactive. In addition to their daily hikes, they volunteer at the local church where Greg conducts the choir and Newton is president of her local Lions Club. While each dog is different, Newton acknowledges when she trained with her newest dog, Lancelot, in 2023, the thing that was most important was that the power of having a fifth dog and getting my life started again. I had somebody who was ready to serve beautifully trained. That's the glory of a guide dog. Her latest guide dog was raised by Lucinda Rimpala, and the puppy sponsor was Joanne S. Miller. The story of Linda Newton, The Glory of a Guide Dog, appeared in The Guideway, Volume 78, Number 2, Fall 2024, the newsletter of the Guide Dog Foundation. Our next reading comes from Best Friends, Together We Can Save Them All, the November-December 2024 issue of Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. And this article is written by Francis Batista, Best Friends co-founder, and it's called The Dogs Who Shaped Me. Each one has been an essential part of the story of my life. Some of my earliest memories are sitting on the front hall staircase of our little house in Maroninck, New York. That's when we were sitting with our dog, a sturdy mutt with a black saddle and ear patches. He was white with black spots on his muzzle, shoulders, front legs, and underside, which looked a bit like a royal robe, so he got the name Prince. He was always Princey to me. He and I would sit waiting for my mother to return from shopping. He claimed the window seat so he could stick his nose under the Venetian blinds and watch for my mother walking in as a wind-up doll model. A 4'11" woman in low heels, moving at a speed with two large paper bags of groceries in her arms. Click, 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 click. High speed, short steps. I could never keep up with her. I would sit next to Prince on the staircase and hug him, telling him my problems, as if I actually had problems. Whatever they were, I shared them with him. To me, he was my dog, my confidant, and I was his boy. But in fact, he was my mother's dog. He wouldn't seem to be paying the least bit of attention to me when she was around. He was all about my mother, but just being with him made me feel good. So he did solve my problems. Occasionally my father would play grainy 8mm home movies, which he never seemed to tire of, featuring my older brother, my sister, and me with the dog who preceded Princey, chasing me around the front yard. I was 2 years old, waving a stick to entice the old girl Foxy to play. My father's other fave was of me in diapers being chased by a goose at summer cabin in Brewster, New York, cutting to me, petting a cat, and squealing with delight. All that is to say that animals have always been a part of my life and were always part of our family. when Prince died, I don't know which was more difficult for the 10-year-old me to navigate, my own sadness and loss of watching my mother attempt to hide her grief and tears from me. Like most of you reading this, I have been dramatically impacted by the animals who have come into my life over the years, how they have entered, how they have departed, our adventures along the way. Too often I only remember their last years and their struggles with whatever finally claimed them. I think about what I might have done differently, or I am focused on the end-stage condition. That misses the essence of the animal in our years of joyful relationship. So, with apologies to hundreds of friends who won't get a mention, this is a thank you to some of the dogs who took on my care and training after Prince. After Princey passed, we moved into a two-family home, which we weren't allowed to have a dog. The owners who lived downstairs barely tolerated the pitter-patter of the rescued kitty I brought home to my folks from college. I looked after the dogs of various friends in the interim, but it wasn't until 1974 that I adopted my first dog, Jasper. He was from a shelter in Miami, Florida, an old, run-down building typical of that era. I took a walk down the row of available dogs and came to the front desk to ask questions when a guy walked with a black and tan Afghan hound who was so matted and dirty that it was hard to tell what I was looking at. His front legs were attached to his hind legs by cords of matted hair. His coat, which should have been silky, was bunched up in pads. His head seemed to have felted crash helmet on it. His demeanor was so downcast that it was depressing. Guy said that a hippie couple had left him behind when they went to the islands for a month. That was 2 months prior. The dog's name was Sakyamuni, which translates from Sanskrit to Sage of Sages, better known as Buddha. A heavily weighted name for such a sad sack, but time would show that he was at least a sage, if not the Sage of Sages. We decided to bypass the intake process. The guy handed Saki's lead over to me. Thus began a wonderful friendship. I changed his name to Jasper and immediately removed what I could of his mats and with scissors. He looked like Dr. Seuss's character, Jasper, blossomed into a magnificent dog, and traveled with me from Miami to Chicago, from Chicago to Toronto, and back to Chicago, then to New York City, and finally out west to Arizona, and then to Kanab, Utah, where he was among the dog's best at friends, groundbreaking day in 1984. In Miami, Jasper ran sports field-sized circles in the park just to stretch his legs. In Chicago, he posed at a sidewalk cafe table and once confronted an escaping burglar with me in the middle of the night as I held him on a short lead as if restraining him from attacking. He was harmless, but I don't think the burglar had ever seen such a creature and willingly emptied his pockets of the items he had lifted. The irony here is that Jasper himself was a thief, the kind who leaves no trace and displays no guilt. I would sometimes leave a plate of food on the table with Jasper stretched out asleep in the corner, and when I returned, the plate was placed nearly on the floor, and it was clean as a whistle. To all appearances, Jasper had not moved an inch. He had gently removed the plate, full of food, from the table, quietly placed it on the floor. The folks who claim that sight hounds are not very intelligent are just testing for the wrong skills. Jasper was chill, graceful, patient, and cool as a cat. He also had the uncanny ability to cure the blinding headaches I used to get. I would rest my head on the side for a quick nap, and the headache was gone. By 1986, when he died of bone cancer, Jasper had ushered me down the aisle of total commitment to animal welfare. He was the first of our rescued sight hounds, followed by Afghans Lancelot, Junior, Sheba, and Buffy, and the racing groundhogs Jet and Tut, along with a Whipple, Brody. They all are now at rest in Best Friends. On one cross-country trip in 1982 with fellow co-founder Faith Maloney and some dogs and cats from the little shelter she was running in New York State, we stopped for gas on the lonely outskirts of Deming, New Mexico. As I was pumping gas, I noticed something move behind a dumpster, a little blonde dog. Because I had the regrettable habit of rescuing dogs who didn't actually need rescuing, I checked with the gas station attendant, who said the dog had been cowering out there for days. Since it was now the next day, and there wasn't another building in sight, I offered her a piece of cheese and loaded her up to join our traveling menagerie. She was some kind of terry poo, her front half silky and her back half kind of frizzed up like a poodle. She rode on my lap for the next 8 hours and didn't reveal her impish charm for a week or so. I named her Goldilocks. Goldie joined me in Kanab, and as soon as we had some dog runs set up behind the bank house where the advance team lived, I'll never forget putting her in the back run that first day, walking through the bunkhouse and out the front door, only to be greeted by Goldie, who had scaled the 6-foot fence in 20 seconds it took me to walk through the building. As Jaster passed away, Goldie became one of a trio of dogs who rode the canyon with me in my truck, and then an old Jeep. Grelly, Zsa-Zsa, also known as Zizi, and Goldie were a great team. Grelly was a beautiful Belgian sheepdog who came to us from local women when one of the dogs ran afoul of her neighbor's livestock and she had to downsize without notice. Zizi was one of several cattle dogs I took from early Dogtown days. Each was smarter than the next. When I sat down to write about how individual animals have touched my life and what I've learned from them, I realized after 40 years of animal welfare work and nearly double that of just living, I would need to write an entire book, and I still wouldn't do all of them justice. For the animal lovers I've known, our pets respect the chapters in the stories of our lives. They are our traveling companions through different phases of our lives, but just as important, they have their own stories, the ones through their eyes. Even writing this, it feels wrong to leave out Billy and Jeffrey and Roxy and Dermont and Bismarck and Teddy and Q and Treat. The list goes on and on. I have been very, very fortunate and rich beyond measure in my friendship. I have more stories to tell of the dogs and cats who were there for me in my story of life, as I was there for them in their story of life. Perhaps I'll pick up the thread down the road. This article, The Dogs Who Shaped Me, Each One Has Been an Essential Part of the Story of My Life, was written by Francis Batista, Best Friends co-founder, in the magazine Best Friends, the November-December 2024 edition. Well, that completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Sun Sounds of Arizona and for Animal Companions. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.